I'd like to welcome you to the next in our series of global health podcasts. We've been looking at the nexus of smoking and major global health problems. And of course, we are deep into the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm really very privileged to have Jerry Stimson join us from the UK. Jerry has really for decades been a global leader in the area of harm reduction, particularly focused in the early years on drug harm reduction, where I think it'd be right to say, and Jerry can correct me, that initially this was not particularly well known as a field, not particularly popular at the time, and has really become pretty mainstream now. What I'm really thrilled is to have seen how Jerry has migrated into the world of tobacco harm reduction at a time when we still have well over 7 million people dying of tobacco worldwide. So the need is extremely high. So to begin, Jerry, it would really be good if you could tell us about your journey first into the field of drug harm reduction, and then how you started looking at what was happening in the tobacco space.
Thanks, Derek, and it's a pleasure to sort of recap over rather too many decades of harm reduction. In fact, it really took off for me in the 1980s when we were faced with an AIDS epidemic and faced with those very difficult problems about what to do to help people who were engaging in risky activities. And in particular, my field of expertise was drug use, heroin addiction, injecting drug use. And the UK, like many other countries, suddenly woke up to the realisation that you couldn't stop people injecting, but how could you help them to reduce their risk of HIV infection and other health issues? The UK was a rapid adopter of what then came to be called harm reduction. That language wasn't around really before that period. I'm talking about the late 1980s. And the UK rapidly adopted needle exchange, expanded methadone treatment and so on. And I was brought in to evaluate the needle exchange program for the UK by the government. So I was a bit of an outside observer, but over the years, I gradually moved, I suppose, I stayed being a scientist for many years, but also became a harm reduction advocate because I saw that harm reduction worked. The harm reduction in the UK was a public health success for drug users.
Yeah, and what was your original background in science, just to let people know?
Well, I was a social scientist, and in fact, I was involved in harm reduction research before we had that word in. The first bit of research I did as a PhD student was to look at what was happening to heroin addicts in London who were being prescribed pharmaceutical heroin. So the question was, did this help and who did it help? And I interviewed a third of all the patients getting heroin in London back in 1970 and then followed them for 7 years. And certainly this helped many people using heroin to lead reasonably stable lives. It didn't help everybody, but it was an example of a pragmatic approach to a serious health problem. And I remember talking to some very significant psychiatrists at the time who said, well, you know, we can't work magic with people, but we can really help them stay alive until such time as they might want to do something different. So that thinking was there. And in fact, I could give you a history lesson tracing that back to the 1920s, but I won't do that. So we've always been doing a bit of harm reduction, although that language is relatively recent in history.
And in those experiences, particularly in the early years, what were the obstacles or some of the opposition, or did that not exist?
There were some political obstacles in the UK because, remember, the response to AIDS was at the time of Margaret Thatcher's government, and I think there was a big fear that there'd be a moralistic approach to AIDS prevention. But that was soon sort of pushed aside, I think, really, because politicians realised that AIDS did affect us all and their families were potentially threatened. So it was very rapidly adopted in the UK, but there was tremendous resistance internationally, and in particular from many UN agencies. So World Health Organization was very much opposed to drugs harm reduction and maintained that for a long time until really impelled into adopting it by other UN agencies like UNAIDS.
Yeah. So how did you actually then start getting into the world of tobacco and tobacco harm reduction?
Well, after I left full-time research, I worked for an international agency to promote harm reduction. And around 2008, 2009, 2010, I started to hear about e-cigarettes. Now, most of harm reduction depends on good products, safer products, and changes in behaviour. And the field of smoking really didn't have the products available that were attractive and effective for tobacco harm reduction. I think many smokers were motivated to use products if they were there, but things like nicotine replacement therapy products are pretty dull, pretty boring, and pretty ineffective. So I started to hear about e-cigarettes, and I started to talk to people who were using them. And I found the tremendous enthusiasm from people who were the early adopters. So I thought, well, this actually fits all that I know about harm reduction, community-based, bottom-up, people doing harm reduction themselves. So I thought this was the bit of magic that tobacco control needed. It wasn't a view that was shared by many of my colleagues, as I discovered, because many of my public health colleagues who might have been very pro-drugs harm reduction, pro-drugs policy reform, when it came to smoking and tobacco, they were very uncertain about this and very concerned about this.
And what do you think was underlying that concern?
I've thought long and hard about this. We don't proceed by evidence alone, but there are deeply held values, deeply held views. I think that in part, it's a bit of a long story, but I think that tobacco harm reduction in terms of safer nicotine products really came from outside of public health. So public health didn't invent this. It wasn't a medical invention that public health then had to sell. So there was no ownership from the start by public health. And so really a bit of fear about where this might be going. They hadn't been promoting the products. It was a true bottom-up, consumer-led public health revolution, which public health people usually try to encourage, but they're really trying to encourage that from the top rather than from the bottom. So again, a fear of no control over what was happening. Next, I think that the tobacco control mentality which had developed was mainly built around negatives. Constraints over smokers and the tobacco industry. So it's mainly an attempt to stop smoking and to stop the industry. So more sticks than carrots. So I think the mindset wasn't up to how to integrate a bit more of a carrot to help people switch from smoking. And I think finally, great fear, misplaced fear, an incorrect fear that this might be a tobacco company ploy to maintain nicotine addiction and to create a new generation of nicotine addicts. And it's very hard if you're working in public health to look at, say, the tobacco industry, which is now involved in e-cigarettes and safer nicotine products, to look at them and say, hey, this is the bunch of people who created the problem in the first place. And now they're purporting to come up with a solution to the problem. That's very hard for people in public health to accept.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I feel it every day, knowing that the tobacco industry is still carrying out some of their dirty old practices, even while many are trying to transform.
Yes, correct.
Now, you played a key role in launching the Global Forum on Nicotine in 2014. And I remember going to some of those meetings in Warsaw. What struck me was the incredible range of users of nicotine products who, frankly, we had cleansed out of tobacco control for decades. And hearing their perspectives was, I think, one of the highlights of the meeting. The other was the centrality of Michael Russell and his work and the oration that you put there. It'd be good to let people know a little bit about why you chose Mike Russell. What was his role in this whole area of nicotine?
Well, we kind of honour Michael Russell with the Michael Russell Oration because back in the 1970s, he was the first person really to push the message that people smoke for the nicotine but die from the tar and the toxins that are inhaled in smoking a cigarette, which is a very dirty nicotine delivery system. So he certainly had the insights that making nicotine products available which were free from smoke might be the way forward for people who didn't want to give up nicotine. And I think it's interesting that Mike Russell himself was rather partial to the odd small cigar. You know, he likes nicotine himself. But the insights, you know, every movement needs its sort of social history of, you know, the progenitors, but it was certainly his insights which helped push harm reduction forward, and then later picked up by the Royal College of Physicians and others. So, yes, we do. The Michael Russell Oration is a highlight, as to, as you've mentioned, the involvement of consumers. So I think there are lots of things that we've done there which make it a really open type of meeting. When we started this, I was taking, I think, a lot of what I'd taken from the drugs field and running conferences there, realizing that the solution to drugs problems wasn't just medics sitting in a conference hall discussing them or international agencies discussing them, but you had to get everybody around the table, everybody in the same room.
Yeah, and I remember that was probably one of the first places that people remind me of the phrase, nothing for us without us, that was actually at the hallmark of the HIV/AIDS demands for better treatment and better access, involving them in the decisions.
Yes, nothing about us without us, taken from disability reform, then picked up by AIDS. And I suppose in my research capacity doing work on harm reduction, I realised that it's, you know, it's always people who are doing harm reduction, not the experts. So you have to get the people on side. So, yeah, giving a voice to consumers, having them as part of what's going on, but also having manufacturers and public health people and government people and so on in the same room. Going back to when I used to run drugs harm reduction conferences, having police, Ministry of Security, Ministry of Health and drug users in the same room was often very lively, but very interesting, because you have to have all those views there. And my abiding memories of the, I suppose, for the Global Forum on Nicotine, it is the big presentations, it is the big discussions, but it's also the side meetings that you see, you know, like a vapor talking to a drug company executive. Never happen in real life, in their normal lives. A little thing we started having consumers chairing panels of scientists. As I said, it's rather like the rats in charge of the lab scientists. So, you know, I find an amusing side to this, but, you know, they are important. So, yeah, you don't just have scientists chairing the sessions, you have consumers chairing the session. So there's little things you can do to bring the discussion along and to involve lots of people.
Yeah, and with over a billion users and consumers of tobacco nicotine products in the world, it does seem a bit of a shame that we haven't involved them in the solutions they seek. One thing which you've played a key role now through your company, Knowledge Action Change, is the global state of tobacco harm reduction, which really, I think, is becoming accepted as the Bible of what is going on, who's doing it, what's the state of the science. How do you feel that's been received, and how widely distributed is it globally now?
Well, I think it's a very important document and a very important website, and we're very grateful to the foundation for funding that work that we do. We are small. There are only a few number of people globally who are promoting tobacco harm reduction. So we have to get the idea across and the evidence across to a wide audience. So the aim of the Global State of Tobacco Harm Reduction report is to provide the evidence and to provide the arguments for tobacco harm reduction. And we know that it's used by many people. The short version of the report is available in a dozen languages. The main report is available in Mandarin. We know it's used when people are making presentations to governments and when they're briefing people about tobacco harm reduction. So it's a little contribution to this broader movement to promote tobacco harm reduction. The first report was called No Fire, No Smoke. That came out in 2018. The next one is later this year, and it'll be called Burning Issues. And it will be a biannual publication to track progress and also setbacks to tobacco harm reduction. There's also a website, so you can go on the website and you can go drill down to countries and see what's happening there with regards to safer nicotine products. and legislation.
And we'll make sure that those websites are available when we put up the podcast as well.
Yeah.
Let me just turn to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think it does seem to many people that the recommendations we all expect to follow are really classic examples of harm reduction. We hear the debates every day ad nauseum about there being no absolutes in this. There will be deaths and there will be disease. Whatever we do, the goal is to minimize them. And I just wonder how you feel in terms of almost being vindicated about the language of harm reduction now being applied to the worst pandemic we will live through, and how, if we get it right, the long-term benefits will be very big.
Yes, this is an awful pandemic. We have to learn to live with it, to try to contain it. We have to learn to how to cope with it. And I think, yes, there are lessons from other areas of harm reduction. As I said earlier, it's people who do harm reduction. It's experts, not experts, who do it. I think it's an indication of how people can change their behaviour. And I think we had that insight with people who inject drugs, because we expected those people who we never thought would want to change their behaviour, we expected them to change their behaviour, and they did. So, you know, people can and do change their behaviour. I think another lesson is that harm reduction works when it's reciprocated, when we are doing it together. We're protecting ourselves but protecting other people. So we're changing a culture of behaviour. But it's also clear that people need the resources to do it, just as it's very difficult for a person injecting drugs to do harm reduction if they're homeless. So too, it's in the case of COVID, it's very hard to do harm reduction for this virus if you're living in a crowded multi-generational, housing, or if you're in occupations where you will have a higher risk of being exposed. So the risk, what sociologists call the risk environment, is very important, as well as the individual behaviour. So yeah, this is harm reduction in action.
Well, Jerry, just before ending, I must say, I hope you're taking care, and I've been enjoying your memorable things within a 45-minute walk, and maybe you could just tell us a couple of these memorable things. It does strike me, and I have a very early morning walk, how the sort of mundaneness of one's local neighborhood becomes very alive when your eyes are open to some of the small things during this pandemic. I'd love a couple of your examples just to leave people with.
Well, there is a refocusing, I think, on the mundane, on the small things, on the small pleasures. So when I've been out for my walks, I have started taking photographs of the River Thames. Unfortunately, I've been taking photographs in graveyards, but there are some interesting memoriams and so on in graveyards. But it is about refocusing. And I think, of course, going out walking, as we're allowed to in the UK, there's also a very important message here about harm reduction, because I've walking the streets of London, I've learned to do what I call the COVID dance. So when you're approaching somebody, you both kind of move out of the way. You don't move together, but you both have this little bit of etiquette where you move within your 2 meters if you can. And that's important because it's practical, but it also sends a message. You know, I'm concerned about your health and you're concerned about mine, and together we control the spread of the virus. So as with all harm reduction, the COVID dance is an interesting little bit of reciprocity that we're all engaged in to protect ourselves from this virus.
Well, that's a fantastic place to end. And thank you enormously again, Jerry. On my walk this morning, I passed a church which has just put up a sign saying, "This too will pass," in handwritten scrawl. But at least to give some inspiration. So to everybody out there, please contact us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org for further details. And stay safe. Learn the COVID-19 dance, as Jerry suggested. And this too will indeed pass. Thank you very much. And thanks again, Jerry.